welcome back to the Cosmic Library, where you can read the greatest stories in all of the multiverse. I am Jeremy.
And I'm Joanna.
We are doing this show in conjunction with Second Union. For more of the latest headlines and entertainment, please go to our website at wearesecondunion.com. Unfortunately, Jesse isn't feeling well tonight, so he's taking the evening off. Joanna, how you doing?
Had a soul-crushing experience. I watched the season finale, the series finale of Supernatural.
Oh, is that what you were talking about? I was about to apologize for walking out of the room without my pants on, but, okay.
No, luckily there's no video. Yeah, I was not prepared for it, and I was just, like, sitting there bawling, like, damn you, Supernatural, how dare you?
You know, my wife has been complaining about that for a week. She is a tremendous fan of that show herself. I could not, and it's nothing bad about the show, in my opinion, but after years and seasons of growing up with Charmed, to me, it was just Charmed with testicles, so I just didn't get into it.
It was way different because they never had an awesome car like Baby was, okay? That Impala is the thing that dreams are made of. I love American Muscle Car, and that car did it for me.
You know, I could make a joke about that car being the thing with the most personality in the show, but that's a bit low.
You know, it's almost true for some seasons. I'll give you that. There were some parts that dragged in some seasons and some plot holes that we're not going to even talk about. But it still hit me right in the feels, and it was, I'm not going to spoil anything for anyone who might be listening and haven't seen it yet, because somebody also spoiled the last of the latest episode of Mandalorian.
You know what? That's been another topic of conversation in the household, because both my wife and I are fans of that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a conversation with someone recently. I don't think it was you guys, because I was using Jesse as an example. I'm just glad that the child has a name, because I want Baby Yoda to go away. I do not like that phrase.
Why? Because everyone knows he's not Yoda?
It's because, to me, the phrase, ever since it came around, and I know it was a director who coined this phrase, it's very reductive to me. Jesse, you know, the other member of the show, to me, is a great example, because when he asked me why I didn't like it, I said, okay, so you're my lone Korean friend, right? He's, yeah. Okay, so how would you feel if every time I saw a small Korean person, because I didn't know their name, I just walked up and said, hey, it's Baby Jesse.
Oh, yeah.
And he just stopped and said, I know you're making a point, but that felt weird. Didn't it, though? I mean, just because Yoda is the only member of the species anyone's ever heard of doesn't mean we have the capability to just call this thing Baby Yoda. I'm sure this race of individuals has a name of some sort.
That's totally valid.
So, and I know it's personal. I know it's the way my brain works, but I sat there and thought about it. I was just like, man, that is really a reductive, just almost mean name.
Well, also, the fans didn't know what else to call it. It looks like a Yoda. It was a babe. Well, it's a child. It's 50 years old.
Yeah, but I mean, there's up until that episode, there have been two schools of thought as to it. There were those people that called it Baby Yoda, and others that refer to it simply as the child. The child was easy for me to swallow because that's literally what it is. And even if that's the only frame of reference we have, it's definitely a child. Mm-hmm. You know, for the sake of some conversations as a shorthand, I took to calling it Stevie because that's a cute little name.
Stevie.
But yeah, Baby Yoda just felt rude.
I didn't really feel strongly one way or another. I get your point completely. That makes total sense. And a lot of people are like, oh, that's a dumb name. But, you know, my main focus on that episode, may I just say, was Ahsoka, because she's one of my favorite characters. Like, I watched it in Clone Wars, and she's back in Rebels. There's a novel that came out just last year, about her time after the Clone Wars, and it would be before this series, how she gets the white lightsabers. She's basically a gray Jedi. It's just really cool lore, and her story is awesome, and she's got a lot of character development.
Yeah, she
also, the casting for her, can I just say, perfect?
Yeah, actually, in that regard, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Because I know that online, in a lot of the message boards, Rosario Dawson's being accused of being a transphobe at this point. And
what?
Yeah, I don't know the details behind this. This has been going on for a few weeks.
I've never heard that.
Really? I was hoping you could... See, I'm sure it's easier to dig into, but it only comes up when I'm thinking about it in passing and don't have a moment to look it up. So I don't know the details behind these allegations. Supposedly, the person that brought up these allegations has, like, recanted them, but the sting of them is still, like, very much pervasive within the Star Wars fandom. So I'm trying to understand what's going on.
Maybe it's, you know, like the boy who cried wolf kind of thing, where, oh, I want the notoriety, or I want some sort of buzz about this person.
That's the problem, is I really don't know. The way that Dawson is portraying it in an interview that came out today, it sounds like it was a case of a major misunderstanding that was aired in public, and people are only remembering the misunderstanding. But I don't even know who brought up these allegations, why they recanted them, when they recanted them, supposedly. I'm really in the dark.
I'd never even heard of it. Just what I know of the actress, like, I would never, unless I, you know, heard of
recording
or saw a video of her say something, like, really horrible, I wouldn't believe that ever, just because...
Yeah, I found it hard to believe...
...projects she's been involved in.
Yeah, I found it hard to believe myself, if only because Dawson herself is, like, a personal friend and long-term co-worker of Kevin Smith, and he is very... I don't want to say selective, but if he finds out people are negative, he tends to either stop talking to them or just plain, like, rant about them somewhere. And he hasn't said anything. So, you know, and I trust his judge of character. He may sound like a dope, but he's one of those people that keeps positivity around him at all times.
Right.
Other than that, you know, Turkey Day was okay. We managed to cook and nothing burned. And then, you know, Black Friday happened, and I got in a couple sales. I managed to buy a few goods for my kids, and I'm not going to say what in case one of them actually listens to this show. I did pick up a little bit of something for myself after talking to my wife and okaying it, because I did not want to make a major purchase without running it by her.
That's smart.
I am a fan of Sideshow Collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
They're the people that tend to resell hot toys, but more importantly to me, they have a bunch of original statues that made of licensed characters. Gorgeous. Oh, yeah, they're unbelievable. So I sent it to you, but I managed to pick up the non-exclusive version of the latest Rogue maquette.
Oh, okay, I'm looking at the link
here. Yeah, it's kind of amazing because the statue makes it look like Rogue is mid-flight. She's got her hand embedded in the side of this swing arm that has a saw blade on the end of it, and it looks like she's getting ready to throw a punch. And I have been enamored with this statue, even though I'm not a big Rogue fan, because the way that this statue is laid out, it looks like she is floating in the air.
Yeah, that's insanely detailed.
I mean, her legs are not connected to anything, so... However they sculpted it, there's got to be some iron going through that saw arm, and her hand is connected to it.
Yeah.
Well, not connected. Wow. I mean, I'm sure it slides in there for this effect, but I'm in awe of how they built this thing, how well sculpted it is, as well as the balance of it to be able to do this.
That's graceful and gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, the exclusive version came with an alternate head that has, like, her 1980s/1990s, you know, big haircut. Yeah. And I respect the era, but I'm not a big fan of that look, so I'm like, okay, that's sold out, I don't need that.
True story.
So yeah, that should be arriving somewhere. I can pick it up in the next couple days.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm a little envious. Okay, I'm a little more than a little envious.
Well, actually,
she is one of my favorite X-Men.
It actually wasn't my first pick. After Halloween, I was going to use the points in, like, a discount code I got to get their latest version of Emma Frost, but apparently that sold out, like, 2 days before I was going to get it. And Emma Frost is, like, she's not my favorite X-Men. She's almost... Crush is not the right word, but I'm just a big fan of how far the character has come and what she's turned herself into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wanted that one, but yeah, that's gone. So this was my consolation prize is not the right word, but I had all this extra and I didn't know if it was going to run out. So I'm like, I might as well use it on something fun.
Right. They have a nice silk one too. The silk spider.
Yeah, they do. And it's like $40 off and free shipping right now. It was up there on my list. You know, then
was actually browsing that a couple days ago just to kind of see. I don't own anything by them because, I mean, it's big bucks. And, well,
it is.
Yeah. I'm not prepared to make that kind of investment.
Yeah.
But all of their stuff is always gorgeous and detailed and just I mean, spectacularly done.
Yeah,
That was worse.
they actually had a Cyber Monday webcast where they did they were showing off like the deals for Cyber Monday. And they had a couple of what they call second chances. I guess when they find extra ones in a warehouse because they've had orders cancel and they just decide to throw them out there for people to buy. And
Oh.
both of them were X-Men related. One of them is like their latest Juggernaut maquette, which is, I think, like $1,400. But they had a
Oh my
couple of the
God.
exclusive version that came with a couple of side pieces, or a side piece that appears to be Kitty Pryde coming out of the ground to attack.
Oh,
So
cool.
I'm sure they were jumped on even at that price range. But the other one was kind of funny because the other one they brought back was the Dark Phoenix maquette, the exclusive version. I was staring at that going, wow, I've never been in a position where they brought back something I already have.
Man, I've seen and oohed and awed over that one too.
Yeah, my living situation is still kind of odd, so I haven't really. I put them up long enough to inspect them, make sure everything's cool, then I put them away. And I don't have a setup to be able to put them anywhere with any kind of confidence. You know, living in California, earthquake zone, I've told my wife wherever I put these things, it has to be affixed to a wall, never to move, and I have to have utmost confidence that these things will never shift around. And it's like, well, you could put them on the dresser. That doesn't even meet the beginning of my criteria.
It's like, not in this world.
Yeah, and the other thing is these things can be an investment. I got my wife the like the first Deadpool premium format,
Oh,
the
cool.
one with a rubber chicken with a stick of dynamite shoved in its rear end.
Yeah, I've seen that.
I bought that for $400. It is now worth over $1,000 in resale right now.
Whoa.
Yeah. So yeah, these things can actually be worth something down the line if you take care of them.
Yeah, but then again, that's what they said about comic books and baseball cards. And oh, and Beanie Babies.
Yeah. And all three right now have better return average returns in the stock market, so.
Yikes.
But the subject of this week is Ghosted in LA issues 1 through 5 by Boombox Studios. We will get to that after the news of the week, and we will start with Marvel Comic News. These are the characters and intellectual properties of the House of Mouse and where they're headed in the next few months. And it appears that Daredevil, the current run with Chip Zdarsky, is headed for issue number 25 that's going to be out soon. And this is going to mark a major change in the status quo for Matt Murdock, which is kind of shocking. We have actually read a couple volumes, and we found out that the status quo for Daredevil seems to be in constant flux since its run started. And in the latest issue, issue number 24, Daredevil actually pled guilty to second-degree manslaughter for the man he accidentally killed in the very first issue.
Wow.
So this is a big shift. Usually the superheroes find themselves as very far above the law, or at least not entirely accountable to it, but Murdock has left himself to be a subject of it. And according to Zdarsky, even though Daredevil's going to be in jail, Matt Murdock may not spend all of his time there.
So, did he, was he actually convicted, or is it still ongoing?
He pled guilty, which means the conviction is a sure thing.
Okay.
The thing is, though, because of a couple legal, not loopholes, just legal changes to the Marvel Universe, people can actually be tried under their masked identities to protect themselves and their loved ones.
Cool.
So Daredevil has pled guilty, but apparently very few people are physically aware that Matt Murdock is Daredevil.
Okay, I thought that cat was out of the bag a long time ago.
It was put back in the bottle I want to say it has something to do with Mephisto, but I'm not absolute on that. No, actually, it was the Purple Children. They did Matt Murdock a solid last time his identity went public.
Oh, that's handy.
They owed him a favor. You know, they're not a fan of their father.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah, but this makes me want to go back and read the few issues of this Daredevil run I have not read yet to find out what's going on. The only things I've found out for sure is that one, Wilson Fisk is still engaging in his secretive fight with the Stromwinds, and he has a new bodyguard to protect him from the Stromwinds and Daredevil, Typhoid Mary.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't hire her, she volunteered. So that makes it even weirder. And Elektra Natchios took the money that she's been stealing during the various jobs with Daredevil and appears to have now made a base for herself in Hell's Kitchen. as some kind of high society magnate. I don't know the details. So, yeah, everything is pretty much upside down in that comic. I need to go back.
Interesting.
Meanwhile, Marvel Comics is not... not everything is roses for Marvel. A few cancellations have been announced.
Oh, no.
Four titles that have been on hiatus since the pandemic started are not being brought to fruition. This includes the limited series of Amazing Spider-Man Daily Bugle, Robert E. Howard's Dark Agnes comic book based on the Conan universe, and the Star Wars Rise of Skywalker comic book adaptation.
I can live without that.
The other thing that's been canceled is the ongoing series of Morbius the Living Vampire.
Oh.
So, yeah, they were also listed before the pandemic started, and now that the pandemic's taken full hold, it appears Marvel Comics has just decided to fully cancel these things for the time being. I can't say I blame them. The Rise of Skywalker adaptation, that would be polarizing at best.
Right.
And Amazing Spider-Man Daily Bugle. If things were good, I would say there's room for that, but under current circumstances, do you really want to read a comic book about a newspaper that reports about a superhero?
Not really.
And then Dark Agnes. I was very curious to read that because I'd never heard of her before, but I admit, that is very much a niche comic book.
I'm not even familiar with it.
I'd have to go back to remind you, but I'm not sure we have the time for it at the moment.
Okay, no worries.
Meanwhile, the Valkyrie tie-in to... No, the Rise of the Valkyries tie-in for the King in Black. The event where the dark symbiote god Null is coming to the Marvel Universe. It's getting an art germ variant, which makes me ask, is a classic Marvel character about to make their return? Essentially, the story, an art germ has done a variant starring the original Valkyrie, Brunhilde.
Ooh, really?
Yes. She has not been officially solicited in this miniseries. They keep talking about Jane Foster leading a new cadre of Valkyries that includes an Asgardian named Hildegard, the part-time Valkyrie, Mirage, from The New Mutants, and then a brand new one, which has yet to be named, but was designed recently by Matteo Dellui.
Yeah, but if the image in the article is the one that's on the cover, that's definitely the original Valkyrie.
I know that's the original, but again, this is a variant cover for the tie-in. So that may not be indicative of the return, but I gotta ask you, if you're building a new crew of Valkyries, who better to return?
True story, and she just started a lot of good storytelling.
I think the Valkyrie, I don't want to say was misused lately by Marvel Comics, but unfortunately it seems like they brought her back in storylines. The character hit hot, and as soon as the character was hot was when Marvel realized they had didn't really have a long-term plan for the character, unfortunately.
Yeah, they had it set up and didn't just follow through.
You mean the relationship between her and the anthropologist?
No, I'm just saying just her run in general. I don't think they meant to keep it for very long.
Ah.
But then it was a big hit, and they're like, well, what do we do now?
I gotta say, I was never really a fan of her classic look, the one here with the armored cups and
the Madonna armor?
The Madonna armor, the blue cape. Her more modern look, which was kind of like this, but with a full set of leggings or pants or long boots, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
She looked like some kind of bizarre Norse secret agent at that point.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I like the updated look. I'm hoping that they do something new with her outfit.
We'll shall see. Hopefully she gets a return, because I think the time is about right. She's been offline since War of the Realms, which granted was not that long ago, but Marvel seems to really be pushing the idea that the women in their universe are as capable as the men, so they're eager to find the strongest women and just bring them to the forefront.
True story, and that's a good place to start with her.
Meanwhile, when it comes to the X-Men universe, Ten of Swords is over. I read that from beginning to end, and we will get into that in a minute, because that actually brought a tear to my eye towards the end.
Aww.
I have never done that in a comic book, but I was kind of amazed.
I have, just, it's, you know, I get emotionally attached to characters, and if they die or something horrible happens, I'm already emotionally invested.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason why I bring up Ten of Swords is because now that it's over, Marvel Comics has announced that the next era of X-Men comics is about to begin. They're calling it the Reign of X.
Hmm.
Or possibly the Reign of Ten, the way things are going.
Right.
And the Ten of Swords is going to have major ramifications for the X-Men line now that it's over. The question is, where do they go from here? And some of the storylines that are being teased in this image that was released with the announcement, as far as I know, they're going to start happening soon, including, I believe, in the Wolverine comics, he's going to get dressed up in his Patch persona, and he's meeting up with Maverick, somebody from his Team X days.
Huh.
But the image itself is littered with possible teasers as to what's going on, and unfortunately for me, I actually know probably about 95% of what's in this image.
Whoa.
Now, obviously, it's a lot to drink in here. But there's several things that stand out to me. Obviously, Emma Frost dressed in all white, but apparently getting ready to hand out an invitation to somebody regarding the Hellfire trading company.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if this thing between her, Kate Pryde, and Shaw is going to come to a head sooner than later.
Mm-hmm.
The little face above her left shoulder, the guy with the strange mustache and the buck teeth.
Yep.
That would be Mad Jim Jaspers.
I was going to ask you if you knew who that was. Yeah. He's creepy looking.
He currently runs part of Otherworld, known as the Crooked Market, which has someone in it that's going to be really important in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
Someone trapped that the X-Men are going to need. I do not know what object Storm is holding in the foreground there. It looks like some kind of miniature dark cube or something, throwing off a little bit of energy, but I do not know what that is.
Or an upside-down diamond.
Possibly. I'm really...
Like a black diamond.
Yeah, I'm just a little lost. The image of Archangel and M.
Yeah, I see this.
Yeah, it appears that Archangel is going to start teaching M what it means to control yourself when you shift, because he, during this period, can change from Angel to Archangel, and M has similar powers, and there may be something else going on with M's psyche, I would guess.
Now, is it that he can change the structure of his wings from feathers to steel?
No, he does a complete transformation. There's Warren Worthington, and there's Archangel.
Gotcha.
So it involves everything. The blue skin, the Archangel outfit coming from I don't know where, the wings transmuting from feathers to metal. And M lately has been doing something similar, but every time she gets, I don't want to say overworked, but when she gets into a heat of battle, she transforms into penance.
Gotcha.
So there's that. There's the Shadow King's face in the upper right-hand corner, who Newsarama wrongly identified as not being seen in this era. He was already seen in the Empire tie-in for the X-Men. And there's Anton Arcade, who lately has been harassing the Black Widow for unknown reasons. There's you can see Cypher in the foreground there with his new wife, Bay the Blood Moon. Nightcrawler probably getting ready to dig deep into his role as the center of faith and matters of the soul for Krakoa. And there was something else. I don't know what's going on with Quentin Quire up there towards the middle in the back.
Yeah, I was trying to figure. And then, of course, there's some shadow figures that you can maybe kind of pick out.
I'm having a little trouble identifying them, but I'm guessing, by the way everything is framed around Cyclops and Jean Grey, it looks like the two of them are getting ready to assemble a team to handle something more specific.
Mm-hmm.
But why they would gray out those particular figures, I don't know. I want to know what makes them important.
Me too. And, of course, we've got Wolverine and X-23.
Mm-hmm.
Is that her current...
That is her current outfit. We discussed a few weeks ago that X-23 is also going by Wolverine these days.
Yeah, but she... and I knew that, but it's gone kind of back and forth a couple times between what she was being called.
Well, it hasn't really been an issue since issue number 5 of X-Men of this current run. She, Sink, and Darwin have been lost in the vault. And they're supposed to be returning in, I want to say, about 2 or 3 months. So we're going to find out what happened to them. There is a lot here, and I have a feeling it's going to play out across multiple series. And, okay, so the end of Ten of Swords, that got brutal. first of all, I think we discussed how in the very first bout, Betsy Braddock was physically shattered like a mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
And all those pieces were gathered up by Saturnine for, I don't know why. So, towards the end of this whole thing, Cable was beat physically by Bay the Blood Moon. She even broke his arm. And Cypher, as her husband, begged her not to kill him. And Saturnine agreed, but she also cut off the psychic link between Cable and his parents, which caused Cyclops to go to the Quiet Council and tell them that he was going to lead a strike team through the portal to rescue their people because they don't know what's going on anymore and he feels like it's turned sour.
Mm-hmm.
But the Quiet Council, one, will not... they will not order anyone to go through, so Cyclops says, fine, it'll be voluntary. And Jean Grey wants to go as well, because while Cable is not her physical son, that's still, you know, the child of her genes, and she feels a connection to him at this point.
Right.
So, as a member of the Quiet Council, she's going to go. However, the Council also voted and said that anyone that goes on this unauthorized mission should not have a seat on the Council, because they're a governmental body. They can't afford to lose themselves.
So she's forfeiting all of that.
Yes, and she basically said, that's not going to stop me. So, going back to the tournament, the final points, the whole thing was tied. And the whole, after Gorgon died, several of characters were, I don't want to say died, but lost or inconvenienced. Mm-hmm. It came down to Apocalypse versus Genesis one-on-one.
Whoa.
And Apocalypse, although he took some damage, he actually beat his wife, opened up a big gash in her with her own sword, no less, after his own broke.
Oof.
But he refused to kill her. Because even he said, it would be sad if I went through all this trouble and all these years to find you, and then it ends this way. However, the dark god that she's been working for, Annihilation, would not accept this result. He demanded that Genesis put on the helmet, and he basically, after that, just forewent the tournament, started summoning his warriors. So the tournament is basically over, the X-Men are trying to defend themselves, and they're facing the entire war army of Amenth, plus the surviving Iraqi swordsman, and it is pitched battle. And mind you, because Gorgon died, there's only 9, maybe 10 mutants there because Jubilee is still hanging out trying to get her son back.
Yeah.
But they are holding their own. Meanwhile, as soon as this battle starts, Saturnine has retreated to the Starlight Citadel, takes out the case that has the shattered Captain Britain in it, and starts to move the pieces around to form a picture of some sort.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, she is working on this. She's got a goblet of wine. She sips from it occasionally, like she has nothing to hurry about, even though there is a war going on underneath her citadel.
Yeah.
And when she finally assembles it, she is irate. Because Why? The idea is she's trying to resummon the Captain Britain Corps. They've been gone for I don't know how long. And she's trying to re-empower Brian Braddock as Captain Britain so that he can lead the forces.
Mm-hmm.
Except, you know, magic itself is fickle, and the image that was reassembled was of Captain Britain in full armor with a glowing purple sword.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, this is why the tear was brought to my eye, because this thing didn't just resummon the Captain Britain Corps. So, if you're not aware, the Corps itself was made up of different people from across the multiverse. One person from each, like, universe, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they varied wildly in the prior version. Except, I don't know if it had to do with the soul of the person who made the spell, or if she is just that indomitable. But instead, this core is made up of various versions of Elizabeth Braddock from across the multiverse.
Really?
There were men and women and animals. All of them had some kind of aspect of purple around them, and several were even carrying, like, psychic construct items like hammers and axes.
Weird.
So this is what answered the call at the very end. But if that was not epic enough, and mind you, this did not summon Betsy herself. She is still lost somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Corps is turning the tide, but they are not turning everything. And Cyclops, I should say, when he was assembling his volunteer force, Kate Pryde offered to go with him, but he said, we're going through Krakoan portals, and she just kind of went, damn it.
Oh.
And Emma telepathically offered to go herself. She's also a member of the Quiet Council. She was willing to give all this up.
So, is Kitty Pryde, I know she's going by different names, but is she sidelined at all? Completely because of that?
Well, the thing is, the mode of transportation Cyclops is not laid out, but they have to go through a crack home portal to get to it. And Pryde still can't.
And there's no other, land way to go?
No, there isn't. And there's another way to get there, but it would take too long, and I think both Cyclops and Grey were trying to keep her on the council because she's someone they can trust. And Emma volunteered to go, but Cyclops convinced her not to because, as he put it, there's too much money on the table. Which is kind of surprising to me that Emma would even offer to go. This didn't seem like her kind of gig. However, she did offer in the same telepathic call to send the Cuckoos over immediately. Which is almost as good, because that means you're going with five teenage Emmas, so whatever.
Yeah.
So, oh my god, this is where it got wild, because Cyclops used Krakow and portals to get him and his volunteers, which included Jean Grey, of course, to the Peak. Sword's orbital station. And then using the Cuckoos and Grey, they reestablished telepathic contact with Magic, and basically gave her some kind of cue. Now is the time. Magic, in the middle of this war, stabs the Soul Sword into the ground, lifts her arms high, and opens a teleportal. And if you don't remember, Magic may be a teleporter, but she's an interdimensional teleporter.
Yeah.
So she opened it above the Starlight Citadel. And she kept pushing herself to open it wider and wider and wider. Until she could fit the Peak station through it.
What?
They brought the Peak into Otherworld, and as soon as it was there, more or less they used the Peak as a multidimensional dropship.
Yeah.
And Cyclops himself did not take lead. He gave a speech basically warning everyone, you know, we die here, that's it. There is no bringing us back as we are. But after he gave the speech, he turned the whole thing over to Jean Grey, who was effectively the field leader here. And I thought they were dropping a team. They dropped just about every character who was worn an X-Badge through this thing.
Whoa.
I mean, it's not all the features. You know, certain people had to stay behind, like Nightcrawler and Pryde and Emma and several others. But, I mean, it didn't take much more than a blink for me to recognize a number of different characters, including, like, Beast and Iceman and I thought I even saw Skids Belvins in there. Wolfsbane, you know, most of the New Mutants seemed to respond to this call as well. It was just an insane war. And the whole thing, believe it or not, was stopped by Apocalypse.
Seriously?
Yeah, he was fighting with Genesis, who still had the Annihilation Helmet on her. He ripped it off, forced it on himself, so the Annihilation Entity was trying to control him and make him the leader of its forces.
Whoa.
And Apocalypse retained enough control to basically get Saturnine's attention. Then he dropped to his knees and immediately surrendered. On behalf of the Amenthi forces that he now controlled.
That's an awesome move.
Yeah, so Saturnine accepted it, ripped the helmet off his head, and as she was trying to hold it there, it said it was going to crack all of her bones, it was going to eat her flesh, and she just suddenly said, oh, that's enough talk from you, and started to reshape it from a helmet into a scepter so that it would still be corrupting, but it wouldn't be as corrupting. So, she basically said that she wants both sides to trade a mutant as a show of goodwill now that the tournament is ended. I know, this is a long aside, but this is a deep story.
Sounds fascinating.
So the Arrakans have chosen Apocalypse. You know, which makes sense. His wife is still alive. Three of his horsemen, I think, are still alive. So they're going to go back to Amenth. And when Saturnine asks the X-Men who they're going to accept as their trade in this goodwill deal, Apocalypse cut off Cyclops because he said he speaks for the Quiet Council here, and he chose the mutant island of Arrakko.
Really?
Yeah, to which Saturnine asked him, and I was not aware of this, doesn't that island have millions of mutant prisoners? It does. And she just smiles and says, well played. And she accepted this deal. So that means the X-Men are about to have their square footage probably doubled with millions of additional mutants.
Whoa. Bold move.
They may not all be very friendly. I mean, these are people who have been stuck in an alternative dimension for centuries.
Right.
But that's a heck of a paradigm shift. And the whole thing ended kind of interesting because it started to lay out the new status quo. You know, several of the kingdoms in Otherworld have had some upheavals. The mutant who used to be able to talk to Arako is now lost and captured due to breaking objects in the Endless Market, which is why you saw Mad Jim Jasper's face, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Crooked Market, I'm sorry. But at the end, I almost felt sad for Saturnine because she corrected her kingdoms. She is sitting on the throne, except they made it clear in the dialogue that while she got everything she needed, she didn't get the one thing she wanted.
Which was?
Brian Braddock.
Mm-hmm.
Her Captain Britain. She didn't get it. And mind you, he's married, so it's very unlikely she was going to, but at the same time, I felt a little bit for her because she's obviously smitten with him, and there's just no way this is going to work right now.
Yep.
So, yeah, if you listen to all that and you're a little bit confused, I would really wholeheartedly invite you to go back and read the 22 parts, and I do mean 22 parts, of Ten of Swords, but that actually felt like an entire Arthurian quest tale.
Yeah, seriously.
You know, and that did not end the X-Men story. That just turned everything around, so now we have to not begin again, but find a new way forward.
A new status quo.
After we just got used to the current one where the X-Men were near immortal.
Well, I mean, but it keeps things lively. I mean, it would get boring and the utopian Krakoa, you know, if it was just let go on, it would be stagnant.
Oh, no doubt. But I mean, even a lot of the stories heading into Ten of Swords have not been really satisfied yet. There's still the issues that X-Force is going through with Xeno, this new anti-Krakoan group of, you know, alliance that seems to be building. There's Ominous Verendi, which has been harassing the Marauders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's even the issue in Excalibur that now their leader is missing at best.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that Excalibur has, you know, part of their foray is regular jaunts into Avalon and Otherworld. So does that mean that every time they go on a mission, they're taking their lives into their hands?
Well, I mean, it would really raise the stakes.
Certainly. So there's still a lot to be settled here.
Mortality can get boring after a while, after all.
However, if you want to read the basis of what we've been talking about, it turns out that now that Ten of Swords is over, on Comixology, I believe it is, you can actually get the entirety of House of X and Powers of Ten digital edition for $10.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry, could. That deal ended at midnight November 29th.
Oh.
That would have been a heck of a way to get an introduction as to where we are.
Seriously.
Meanwhile, there's a new anniversary comic coming out for the X-Men that seems to be teasing the restarting of a rivalry from the New Mutants era.
Okay.
It's part of the Chris Claremont anniversary special. And as part of it, we knew there was going to be a new story revolving around Mirage, the young mutant and former New Mutants leader who has the powers of a Valkyrie.
Yep.
Turns out the rivalry that she's having restarted is with Hela.
Oh, really?
Yep, the Marvel version of the goddess of the dead in Norse mythology.
Well, yes and no.
I said in Marvel Comics.
Yeah, in Marvel Comics, yes. Norse mythology is a little bit more complex than that.
Yeah. But
okay, we'll go with that.
In Marvel Comics, Hela has always been kind of fascinated with Danielle Moonstar because once her Valkyrie powers activated, she always found it curious that there was a mortal Valkyrie and seems to have taken it upon herself to relentlessly tease her.
Yep. I mean, what else are you going to do with your time?
Yeah. Well, for a while, Hela was actually dating Thanos.
Why?
Goddess of Death.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But it appears that in a new story that's being with art by Bill Sienkiewicz, the artist behind the infamous New Mutants Demon Bear saga, this story is going to get told. Sienkiewicz himself went on Twitter and said, quote, "I completed the 8-page intro-outro bracketing sequences. Can't wait to see it all come together," unquote.
Hmm.
So, Mirage has never been my favorite New Mutant, but she's definitely one of the most complex on that team.
And that's saying something.
Really. Meanwhile, Adam Kubert is working on the 350th issue of Wolverine, and that's legacy numbering. That doesn't necessarily reflect the current numbering. The 350th issue of Wolverine will be the upcoming Wolverine number 8, and he's saying it has a James Bond kind of vibe. He calls it, quote, very fast-paced and reckless, unquote, which sounds like every Wolverine adventure, frankly. I've never known Wolverine to actually think through a lot of his scenarios. And finally, when it comes to Marvel Comics, there is an actual tie-in issue that is supposed to... I'm trying to figure out the right way to describe this. If you buy the Chris Claremont collection, which is currently available for pre-order until December 4th, you will get a special tie-in comic that is not being released in stores, being called Uncanny X-Men 140.5. It is supposed to be a flashback tale showing a prequel to the Days of Future Past storyline written by Chris Claremont. And that sounds really special to me. I would be super curious to read this.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is this particular collection they're talking about, the Claremont collection. One, it's being released in March of 2021. And two, I looked it up because I was curious. The collection costs $199.
Ooh.
Yeah, you have to be committed to get this. And as much as I'm a fan of the Claremont era of X-Men comics, I mean, they built half of what we've been going through lately, frankly. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do not have $200 to just drop on this. I just bought a Rogue statue, for crying out loud. So, I would love to read the story, though.
Yeah.
Next up, we have DC Comic News. This is where we talk about the other major company in comics and where their characters and storylines are headed now and in the near future. And there is somebody who has enough money to make this kind of purchase, and I'm jealous of him on several levels. There was a recent auction for Batman Comics, and there was an issue of Detective Comics number 27 made in May of 1939. It's a 10-cent comic. I wouldn't even say it's relatively a key issue, but at 7.0, it's in rare shape.
Whoa.
Yeah. 64 pages, and this was sold at auction and went for $1.5 million, a new record paid for a comic book.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. A 7.0, issue number 27 of the original run of Detective Comics, went for $1.5 million. According to Heritage Auctions VP Barry Sandoval, quote, I'm not at all surprised at the result. After all, this is one of the best copies you will ever see of one of the most important comic books ever published, unquote. Sir, you and I vary greatly. Because I'm astonished at that result. I don't know. The previous record paid for a comic book was $1.075 million for the same issue. Issue number 27 of Detective Comics graded an 8.0 by the Comics Guarantee Company in 2010. So basically, whoever bought this basically paid for the appreciation after 10 years of age.
Sheesh.
According to CGC, there are only 7 known unrestored copies of Detective Comics number 27, including the 2 that have been sold at auction. So these people, whoever they are, they own a very rare comic book.
Hmm.
If you were around in 1939 and you were available to buy Detective Comics off the newsstand for 10 cents, even if you use inflation to get you to 2010 prices, that would still be $1.87.
Sheesh.
This is a record for Batman Comics. The most expensive comic book ever sold is a 9.0 CGC graded copy of Action Comics number 1 sold on eBay for $3.2 million in 2014.
Who has money for that?
I don't know. Whoever they are, I'm not sure if they're making smart or terrible buys, because I'm not arguing that these comics are not worth millions. I'm really not. Mm-hmm. But you have to be at a certain age to be able to either appreciate what you have or allow these comics to age even further to be worth more later. And I don't know if that's who these people are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whoever owns them, kudos to you, man. You got something special. Even if I'm not a DC fan, I will not argue the value of these comics.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Wonder Woman appears to have been underestimated by her enemy in the DC universe.
Well, that's the last time they'll do that.
Oh, well, by issue 767 of Wonder Woman, if you remember, we read the first few issues of this run, I think starting with 757.
Mm-hmm.
She was dealing with Maxwell Lord as her partner because Maxwell Lord had an unknown daughter who ended up calling herself Liar Liar that tried to enact a plan to break him out of prison, and it didn't turn out the way she intended.
Right.
Well, approximately 4 issues after we stopped reading, Maxwell Lord had had enough of playing nice.
Of course.
He even tried to bring the full brunt of his abilities back on Wonder Woman because he knew that if he was caught doing something illegal, he would be sent back to jail. And the illegal thing he was doing was he got a copy of the technology Liar Liar used to put other people under her thrall.
Uh-oh.
He even used his powers once he was aware that going back to prison was basically going to be a life sentence. He tried to get Diana to kill him again. And Diana exhibited that she actually has a measure of resistance to Lord's abilities. She was enraged enough where she hit him hard enough to knock him out without killing him.
Nice.
So it appears that this partnership is already over. And I know you had issues when we read that storyline of Maxwell Lord being such a major player in that series, even though it had Diana's name in it. I agree with you on that. But I'm almost as equally incensed that they set up this new status quo with Maxwell Lord as a partner. And granted, it was highly unlikely to end well.
Yeah.
But they stopped it already after, like, 10 months.
I mean, I didn't expect it to go long.
I expected it to go longer than that, because about the time you get used to the idea that maybe Lord may do well here is about the time they shut the whole thing right down. They didn't even really bother to tease it out. 10 months sounds like a lot in comic book, in linear time anyway, in real world time. In comic book time, that's kind of a flash.
Yeah.
You know, that's 200 pages. That's barely a graphic, that's 2 graphic novels nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't feel like they plumbed the depth of the story they could have had before they changed it. Again, not disappointed that Lord betrayed her. It was inevitable. I'm just disappointed it was so quick.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Diana has had other stories in Justice League Dark, and they have been fighting something called the Upside Down Man.
Mm-hmm.
As of issue number 28 by Ram V and Amancy Nahuelpan, the Mystic Heroes of DC actually had to make a rather major sacrifice to stop him. See, Zatanna... The Upside Down Man is basically the living embodiment of all the dark costs of magic in the DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to stop him, they've already lost John Constantine, and Zatanna was going to absorb all this magic into herself. I imagine that meant she was going to be destroyed by attempting to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they were interceded. Somehow, some vestiges of her father, Zatara, interrupted the process. Not only did he manage to restore John Constantine, he accepted the burden that Zatanna herself tried to take.
Oh.
So the last vestiges of her father died in her stead.
Yikes.
Yeah. So almost... According to the story on CBR, they call him the first magic hero of DC Comics. I do not know if that's true. Either way, one of the most powerful magicians in DC did just lose and probably any chance of resurrecting her father.
Yeah, but then, you know... The big bad is gone.
For now, I mean, if the Upside Down Man really is the vestige and result of dark magics and its cost in DC, it's almost inevitable it's going to return.
Yeah, when is a villain ever really gone?
I don't know. I mean, they even come back from beheading these days.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that for certain. Again, not a major DC reader, but I do appreciate legacy and, you know, how these heroes affect other people, and for Zatara himself to actually make an appearance in DC and almost as quickly be ushered off the mortal coil, that's a little sad.
Yeah, agreed.
And last up in DC comic news, there's actually a character who is back on this mortal soil, and I'm actually kind of floored by it.
Who?
Remember when we read the first volume of Suicide Squad?
Yes.
Remember how sadly that ended when Jog, his job was to get all the triggers to the bombs in everyone's heads, and he got everybody's except for his own?
Mm-hmm.
The final issue of this storyline came out, and in the very beginning of it, Jog's body was in a morgue. And then after a crackle of dark energy, his head was back on his body.
Really?
Yeah, it turns out that he was visited by his father. And I wouldn't blame you if you didn't know this. I don't even know why I knew this. But the cosmic entity known as the Dark Racer is his father.
I do not know who that is.
I'm sorry, the Black Racer. The Black Racer is one of the avatars of death in DC Comics.
Okay.
I believe the first one was chasing down Flashes as the I think he was the first sign of death for speedsters originally, before it turned into this almost zombie-looking Flash type item.
Gotcha.
Turns out Jog is his son.
Hmm.
Yeah, not only did the Black Racer find him, but he basically he took away the limitations, so Jog is no longer somebody who has super speed and short bursts. He still has dad bod, but he doesn't run like a dad anymore.
Interesting.
So it was actually almost hilarious, because when the Black Racer restored him, he said, okay, now is the time that you take your place among the gods, and Jog is looking for his clothes, and he just says over his shoulder, nope, now is the time... I'm sorry, did you just say nope? He said, yeah, godhood? Oh, that sounds terribly monotonous and boring. Where are my friends? I mean...
He turned him down flat.
Yeah, he did. And he basically said, we're gonna have to talk about you being a deadbeat dad later. Yeah, later. He was strangely... I guess he knew already that his father was a Black Racer, and he was not impressed by the fact that his father brought him back to life and fixed his... Not fixed, but augmented his abilities. But, yeah, Jog is back, and he's badder than ever.
Hmm.
And I swear, if you are a fan of offbeat comics and you have skipped Suicide Squad by Tom Taylor issues 1 through 11, now that this run is over, go back and get those. Those are fun. Those are fun, entertaining comics. I mean, the storyline basically had them about to be destroyed by the second TNT, somebody else who'd been experimented on, like the rest of the revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
Zebra Man was barely holding together the explosion with one of his telekinetic bubbles, and just when his powers were about to fail, he kept saying, I can't hold it! And that's when, Deadly Six, the one with the dial that allows people to feel the... that allows him to weaponize the deadly sins minus lust.
Mm-hmm.
He basically said, sure you can, and turned on Pride, and it's like Zebra Man's face just, he got resolute and he said, of course I can hold this. That's when Jog showed up, grabbed Zebra Man, ran out into the ocean, who's still trailing this telekinetic bubble behind them, holding the poor exploding TNT. Then he told him to release it, he ran back, and as there's this gigantic explosion over the ocean that everyone can see, Jog puts down Zebra Man, and he says, okay, so the exploding girl out there, do I just leave her in the middle of the ocean? No! Okay, I'll be back. The whole thing was just funny, and I nearly laughed myself stupid, because Ted Kord, we know that Black Mask has been masquerading as him, he's the one that's been running the Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kord brought the Justice League, because he knows that the squad is in over their heads and they need help. So Batman is telling all of them to hold it where they are because they're all convicted criminals. You know, they're escaped criminals.
Right.
Because they're in the country of Bidinsa, remember Ares' mother is the president there? They brought her out, and basically this woman gave a verbal smackdown on Batman. She basically said, all these people here are heroes, and... You know, they were, they were forcibly used by Americans. And if Americans had handled their own internal problems before letting them get out to the rest of the world, this wouldn't have happened, would it?
Ooh, need some salve for that burn?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Even Wink was just saying, dude, your mom just smacked down Batman. I know, isn't it awesome?
Somebody has a new hero.
Yep, and, Harley Quinn officially left the team. She feels like it's time for her to move on, which is what we've been arguing since this series started.
Thank you.
And, it appears that the Revolutionaries are going to start a new group of stories in an unknown series because the Revolutionaries worked together to find the 5 or 6 individuals who all had a hand of putting Black Mask in power and at one point or another running the Suicide Squad during a phase that ruined all of their lives because, remember, the Revolutionaries all had their lives affected by a Suicide Squad mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have to laugh myself stupid because at one point it's Deadly Six driving a golf cart with Osita, their burly leader, on the back of a golf cart. And I'm like, where the heck are they going? And, I realize they're about to hit someone. And the two guys in suits draw guns and say, Mr. President, get down.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to guess who that looked like?
Mm-hmm.
So Deadly Six uses sloth powers, made the two guys with suits go to sleep. they hit the president, and I'm not going to say who this looks like, with a golf cart. They park half of it on him. And Ozita picks up the golf club he dropped and said, you know, I never picked up golf. Never thought I'd be much good at it. But then again, if you do it, how hard could it be? And whacked him in the side of the head with a club.
Wow.
So the squad basically dragged all these people back to an unknown location and threatened them. They said they had the information. They know that these people have been running the squad at one point or another, ruining lives. And that time is over. And if they try to do it again, the squad is going to come back, and this time they are not going to leave people behind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the series ended, and it does seem like the revolutionaries have more of a story to tell.
That's cool.
I hope Tom Taylor's still writing it, though, because he has made these characters so amazing, in my opinion.
Now, why can't they translate that to the big screen?
I don't know. I mean, there was one scene where, Thylacine and Chaos Kitten, the two physical warriors in the squad, had to go grab one of the generals that they were after in this final issue. And then the next time you see them, there's a pitch battle. The two of them are fighting everybody, and Thylacine just asks out loud, so why couldn't we just sneak in here? And there's Chaos Kitten. Somebody's in a headlock. She's kicking another in the face. Oh, what fun would that be? Bam!
Oh, man.
I already missed this series, and it just ended like 2 weeks ago.
It sounds like a fun run.
I think it fits your sense of humor. I really would recommend getting like digital copies of it just to laugh at.
I'm probably going to hunt it down.
I'm going to look for the trades myself. I'm just having too much fun. I can't even guarantee the comics are going to be worth anything, but I'm enjoying them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, last up, we have general comic and convention news. This is where we talk about comic books that are not Marvel or DC related, as well as conventions happening all over the internet. As we discussed last week, we're heading into the holiday period, which means news on conventions especially slows way down.
Mm-hmm.
We do still have a few news stories about other comic books, including a new collected version, Volume 2, of The Witchblade.
Really?
Yeah, Top Cow Productions is relaunching The Witchblade with a hardcover edition of the complete collection, Volume 2. It's going to Kickstarter right now. If you're curious about it, in this collection, you can actually get a number of recreations of the first version of Witchblade that stars Sarah Pazzini.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to it, if you Kickstart this thing and order yourself a copy of this collection, it's going to come with a special first ever released in this collection one half issue that's written by Marguerite Bennett with art by Aurelia Cristana, with an original black and white cover by co-creator of The Witchblade, Mark Silvestri. And Silvestri himself is going to sign every hardcover and print backers' names in the thank you section.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, that may not be necessarily a signed copy of this, but that would definitely make it a limited edition comic, similar to what we were talking about with the Claremont collection earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a super fan of The Witchblade. However, you know, Silvestri's work was transformative back in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it does make me curious. I'm going to consider it, but I can't guarantee that I would be able to spend the money on this. They did already pass their goal with 35 days to go. The goal was $20,000, and they already have over 60.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. To get a copy of the hardcover collection, you need to pledge $50 or more. That's the physical version. You can get the digital version at $30 or more, but you know me, I prefer physical copies of things.
Yeah. Man, this is a really bad time to be unemployed.
Yeah,
Anytime is a bad time, but especially like with all the stuff coming out and right before the holidays, like, come on.
Yeah, it'd be better for me if I didn't already spend serious amounts of money on my kids' Christmas presents, but whatever.
I mean, luckily, my cats, you know, they're pretty cheap to shop for. Also, they like the boxes that these things come in.
Well, as a matter of fact, this collection actually marks something else, because not only is the second hardcover collection coming out, but part of the reason this came out now is because Top Cow has announced that Marguerite Bennett is going to be the regular writer on a new version of the Witchblade comics.
Oh, really?
Yep, the series is coming as a collaboration between Top Cow and Image Comics in 2021. Marguerite Bennett will be the writer of it, and Ariel Christentina is going to be the artist. And the thing is, lately, Top Cow has tried to relaunch the Witchblade with a new holder. In the original comic, Sarah Pazzini passed away.
Mm-hmm.
They've already confirmed that in this new Witchblade comic, Sarah Pazzini is returning. She's reclaiming the Witchblade and the title that goes with it. According to Bennett, quote, Witchblade is iconic. I'm utterly delighted to be bringing Sarah Pazzini back to her stalwart fans and honored to have the chance to introduce her to a new generation of readers. We're going through a world of cosmos and mythos, horror and sensuality, romance, and danger. And I couldn't be happier to be working with Ariella and Mark Silvestri on making this impossible dream a reality, unquote. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, so many characters get relaunched in larger universes, there's got to be room for Sarah Pazzini in her own little mini, within Top Cow to get a new life, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The only question I have is, if the Witchblade is coming back, does that mean we're getting the Darkness to return as well?
I don't know. I'm not super familiar with that series.
Okay, let me do my best to lay this out. So, the Witchblade is basically a mortal weapon that was made to fight on behalf of humanity because the forces of heaven and hell will occasionally bring their wars and their warriors to Earth.
Right.
It was something that was made to fight both angelic and demonic entities. The Darkness, think of it as the general of the forces of darkness on Earth.
Gotcha.
You know, it spewed out this black miasma that could be formed into a number of things. Tendrils, things with mouths, full-on homunculi. But the Darkness has one major limitation.
Uh-huh.
It cannot work in light. So when the lights are on, the Darkness is very tightly controlled, relegated. But once the lights go out and the shadows are everywhere, the Darkness can run free.
Hmm.
And, of course, there is an angelic counterpart. They call it the Angelus. Usually inhabits a host, and whoever that host is, usually a woman, comes with a giant pair of ram horns and the ability to spew fire and, you know, holy devastation, obviously.
Holy devastation, Batman.
I know. I as soon as I said that, I regretted it.
You knew I was going to jump on that.
Well, somebody had to, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of jazzed to hear that the Witchblade is returning.
Hmm.
Last story in general comic news: there are new Arthurian epics and hereditary monarchies getting a twisted tale in The Orphan King. It's being written by Tyler Chin Tanner and the art is by James Boyle. It's going to be an original graphic novel. I do not have information as to which company is putting it out. It's going to be part of a newer company called A Wave Blue World. It's part of their new young adult graphic novel line. It's coming out in early 2021 to go on sale June 2nd. According to the solicitation, quote, Prince Kaidan, born to inherit the throne, is set to complete his secret training with his aunt, the magical lady Telesia, when tragedy strikes. He returns home to find his parents missing and his kingdom destroyed, along with everything he'd ever hoped and dreamed. With the monarchy overthrown by a rapacious warlord, Kaidan is set adrift in a lawless land where his royal lineage now means nothing but danger. There's a steep price on his head, and everyone is eager to cash in. But when there are no laws, outlaws can become allies, and Kaidan's got a fighting chance with some new friends on the fringes of society. A new path is set. Find whatever pieces of his old life he can and use them to build something new, if he can live that long, unquote.
Ooh.
It's actually a bit of a different tale, because it makes it sound like the story isn't to regain his kingdom so much as find a way to live.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit rare for these types of tales.
Intriguing.
More than a bit. I'd like to know how this shakes out, but it's going to be at least half a year before we can even begin to find out.
Oh, man.
Well, June 2nd, 2021. So I may have to put that on a watch list of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the subject of this week is Boombox Studios' Ghosted in L.A. This is a relatively new series, and it's about a young woman who has moved to L.A. recently and is trying to find a way to live with a bunch of roommates who do not.
That's a good summary.
It's created and written by Sina Grace, illustrated by Saban Keenan, colors by Kathy Lee, letters by DC Hopkins, all covers are by Saban Keenan. And, I will not say it's my favorite tale. I see the bones of something fun here. I just don't know how long they're going to allow things to kind of build and develop. I don't feel like I got a full view of most of the characters of this series yet.
Yeah. I read through the first issue. Mm-hmm. Like I said, a friend handed me a physical copy, and I was like, you know, let me take a look, see what this is. I thought it was kind of playful, kind of an interesting take. It's something almost completely different from what we normally read. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, we can branch out. We read anything and everything, basically.
Right.
Within reason.
I had no problem with the subject matter. It was just one of those cases where I think by the third issue, it almost felt like the story was starting to spin its wheels. Like it was trying to get to somewhere and it still hadn't moved forward. Mm-hmm. And in the second half of these six issues, other than the whole issue with one of the more malevolent spirits, I think his name was Maurice, it really didn't advance much at all, and that was frustrating to me.
I mean, it there were some places where it dragged, but I don't think it stagnated.
It did and it didn't. There wasn't much character growth, and again, I know it's a new story, set within its own continuity and its own universe.
Mm-hmm.
But, unfortunately, the main character herself, Daphne. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Daphne is a basket case.
Hey, who isn't? It's 2020.
I know, but Daphne herself, just, for a woman who is very self-assured and rather intelligent, she seems to have no capability for self-reflection.
So I think that it's more than being self-assured. It's kind of a facade that's being portrayed like, oh, you know, I need to be self-assured, so therefore let me emulate this. And she's kind of a chameleon. One of her friends points out, like, hey, you change your pattern with each boyfriend you date. When you're with this group of people, you're this way.
Mm-hmm.
And her best friend lays it all out, like, yeah, you need to make decisions for yourself. But then when she finally does and decides, wow, this person's being bossy, I don't like it, you know, then the tune changes.
Yeah, Daphne definitely needs to plan better. She tends to go where the winds blow, and that definitely gets her in trouble more often than not.
Oh, yeah.
So Daphne's major story is that she's leaving her life in Montana behind to go to college in L.A. because she's following her boyfriend at the time, Ronnie.
Big mistake.
It usually is, yeah. I mean, I know, yeah, there's people out there who say I can make it work, but trust me, we've all said that, and we've all made the same damn mistake.
We've all said that. We've all failed. This is how I got to Texas.
Yeah, we're awesome. We're better than you. Oh, no.
Like, oh, I can make this work. Maybe you have doubts, but... And then it blows up in her face, like, as soon as she gets there. It seems like she had just gotten settled in her roommate, in her dorm, rather.
Yeah, unfortunately, Michelle...
falls apart.
Unfortunately, Daphne is a sunny Jewish girl, and her dorm mate, Michelle, is an emo goth Christian, which is a really interesting conversation.
She's also very antisocial and wants nothing to do with this person that's chatting her ear off.
Yeah, I was disappointed that in six issues we did not find out what caused that wicked scar on her lips.
I wanted to know so badly, and I'm hoping that maybe it will eventually be revealed, and maybe why she's so, you know, closed off. I'm sure there's reasons, but they didn't even hint
It wasn't even a point of discussion. I mean, sure, she's stripped down and she doesn't appear to decorate at all, other than the giant cross hanging over her bed. But at the same time, I'm looking at her just thinking, did you get into a knife fight? Were you Wolverine in a different life? Do we bow down and call you Laura Kent? What did you do?
Yeah. And I think maybe once the story gets some traction, they might circle back to it. This is my hope. I'm not holding my breath, but I have a feeling that it's going to somehow be brought up. Like, she was two-dimensional in that we didn't find out much about her, mm-hmm. but she was not one of those get-lost-in-the-crowd nondescript because of the way she dressed, the way she acted, her scar on her face. I mean, she was intriguing. She definitely had the potential for being an interesting person.
Right.
I'm just hoping that they circle back to that.
So do I. And unfortunately, Daphne tried to meet up with her boyfriend, who was already supposed to be at this college, and he stood her up. She was waiting for 2.5 hours. She went back to her dorm room, and Michelle is having a group Bible study, and I really am starting to think this is code for something, because this doesn't look like any Bible group I've ever seen.
And they're all girls.
Well, I mean, the fact that they're all girls does not mystify me, but the fact that they're all girls who look like they dressed out of the high-end version of the Macy's catalog does confuse me.
It could be a private college.
I suppose. But Daphne decides to use her bike and go visit her boyfriend Ronnie in his dorm, and not long after she arrives, he's nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, strangely nervous. And he does break up with her in the middle of this conversation. Not in a cavalier way, but just in a very blunt and forward fashion that was disarming.
It was realistic, though, because, I mean, I've been there, personally.
Yeah.
And you follow somebody out to a different state, they dump you shortly after, and they still want to be friends, and they're like, ha-ha, drop dead, man. Like, yeah.
Well, Daphne,
take a hike.
Yeah. Well, Daphne is despondent enough that she wanders down the streets near her college and ends up in the courtyard of an older apartment complex. And she just decides to strip down to her underwear and take a mind-clearing soak in the pool. And as she's sitting down there floating, just ruminating over the last couple hours, is when pretty much a 90s Valley girl appears beside her. Mm-hmm. And as she pops out...
Water.
Yeah, and talking, no less. But as she pops out, she discovers that this is a ghost, and as she's screaming for help, she runs through a second ghost, and... You know, when she runs into a room, she runs into a third ghost, and things just kind of multiply from there.
Just like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah, there's a lot to process. So when she wakes up, three of these ghosts are hanging over her, while a fourth one kind of leans through the ceiling, complaining about the level of noise.
Yeah, he's one of those get-off-my-lawn kind of ghosts.
He's not that old. He's definitely... He's more like a angry Mr. Wilson yelling at Dennis the Menace, and that is his only gear.
Yeah.
But when Daphne finally calms herself, she realizes she's staring at six spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a long... Well, it's not a detailed conversation necessarily, but more or less when she finds out about these things and agrees to never talk about it because these spirits are doing their best to live their afterlife at this location. They can't leave it. For the most part, anyway.
Yeah, well, the first rule about Ghost Club is you don't talk about Ghost Club.
Right, but Daphne has this offbeat idea to live here.
Well, I wouldn't want to go back to a hostile environment either.
Neither would I, but there's nothing that says that this environment isn't hostile so far. It was an interesting flip to me to just say, okay, so this is preferable to anything else going on in my life. Really? Is it?
She'd rather live with the six ghosts than the... semi-hostile roommate. I've been there.
But basically because most of these ghosts cannot leave the grounds and cannot interact with the world in exchange for living there, Daphne is going to do favors for the ghosts. Go out, pick up magazines, latest records, you know, just do odds and ends for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be more of a symbiotic relationship. And if you're asking about maintenance of this place, there is a groundskeeper who apparently is near blind, so he doesn't know who he's talking to half the time.
Which is great.
But at the beginning of the second issue, we get a little bit of a flashback that shows that Agnes, who is the owner of this place and the oldest ghost in it, was apparently bought it after she and her husband in the entertainment industry had a divorce and she was looking for something of her own.
Mm-hmm.
And she intended to make this apartment complex basically not a social center, but a place for young women looking to make a career in Hollywood to stay safely.
Yeah.
And the following day, after Daphne centers herself and gets back to class, she is hit on by an absolute D-bag.
Yeah, and then he pushes her around, kind of manipulates her to give him her number.
Yeah, he kind of browbeat her into a date.
And that's a jerk move.
Well, I mean, part of it was just kind of revenge dating because she was jealous that Ronnie was in the cafeteria with them, talking to a rather attractive young woman. And she assumes this is why...
giggly.
Yeah, she assumes this is why they were broken up all of a sudden.
Which, I mean, given the setting, yeah, the setup did make it seem like he was just a jerk.
So while Daphne is still trying to understand this, she goes back to her dorm room to pick up a few things to for her new living situation, unofficial living situation anyway. And her roommate Michelle is still there, and Michelle is obsessed with what's the right way to put it? HBO level vampire stories?
It was like one of those, I don't know, it kind of like seemed like a bad version of the, what is that one?
True Blood.
Vampire Diaries or something? Yeah.
Yeah. She's definitely into homoerotic vampires, and which seems to be par for the course these days, but still. Michelle is still not willing to open up. The only detail we got is that apparently she's Danish, who emigrated to the US and lived in Ohio for a while. But that's all Michelle is willing to share. She is very guarded.
Maybe she's in witness protection program.
Not with that lip.
I mean,
And we're also discovering some new things about the ghosts that inhabit the apartment complex Daphne is now living in. Ricky, for example, is a young man who, when he passes through electronics, he disrupts it and he's able to change the channel or affect the volume in certain ways, although he can't control it very finely. It's more or less hope. But Ricky does have an impressive music collection that he cannot change the records on. And Ricky is shy.
Extraordinarily.
Terminally. Oh, wait, that was a pun. Never mind. But he's definitely approaching the idea of flirting with Daphne, but is unable to even attempt it. However, Daphne has decided to take her erstwhile, mean guy's date out to an indie bar to listen to a band, and the guy just couldn't even attempt to be interested.
Clearly.
Yeah, he definitely did everything he could to put the cheap moves on her, and it was both telegraphing and obvious and lazy. It was to the point where he almost picked a fight with another fan and got them thrown out of the venue. Probably about two songs in, frankly.
I hate those kinds of people, but they exist.
Yeah. He followed her all the way back to her new apartment building and was still trying to put on the moves until both Ricky and Agnes burst through the electronics in the room and just scared the bejeepers out of him.
As well he should be.
Yeah, but the irritated one in this scenario is Maurice, the dad ghost.
He's more like the grumpy uncle.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it just doesn't seem to be getting better for Daphne, who's out in the courtyard trying to get some air, and Ronnie has shown up on his bike because she sent a bunch of panicked texts about the guy following her to her apartment. And she left the Find My Friend, or, yeah, she left her GPS on her phone, which made it easier for him to trace.
Which struck me as kind of creepy on his part. I mean, helpful because, you know, she was in a bad situation.
I know, but to be fair, like 48 hours ago, they were still dating.
Yeah. That's it's too soon, but who else does she have to reach out to in her panic?
Right.
It's just a messy situation. But again, it's something relatable because awkward things happen in life that you don't
You don't.
ideally want to be in,
Yeah,
but
well,
then
yeah, when you're
you work
breaking up
through
with
it.
somebody, you're not instantly trying to list all the things that you're connected on and trying to sever those connections. You're still trying to deal with the emotions first.
True story.
Unfortunately, both Ronnie and Daphne in the third issue are basically dealing with hedgehog syndrome. They're both so intent on needling each other, neither of them are really discovering what's going on with either of them.
Yeah.
And it causes Ronnie to leave in a huff. So Daphne the next day is on a museum tour as part of one of her art schools, and the only ghost in this pl in her situation that is able to leave the grounds meets up with her at the museum, which just instantly freaks her out.
Yeah, Bernard.
Yeah, Bernard, and he wants Daphne to invite Ronnie back to the apartment complex for unknown reasons, but he swears he senses something. And I thought he meant that he was going to be able to smooth over whatever situation between them. I didn't know he picked up on Ronnie's gay vibe.
You know, ghosts know.
Well, it helps that Bernard himself was gay in life. Unfortunately, he died at one of those periods in I think it was the 80s, where it was still very unpopular to be gay.
Yeah, and he's in a lawyer. He was in a law firm or he was in law school?
He was in a firm, I think, because he his partner at the time was working in, I think, the entertainment or music industries, and his partner wanted time, but Bernard could not get away from his work.
Yeah.
So Bernard is definitely one of those guys who didn't get a chance to live life to the fullest before he passed away.
Because being a workaholic is a real thing that people can easily get sucked into.
Yeah. But basically, while he manages to convince Daphne to bring Ronnie back, unfortunately, Bernard accidentally outs himself. You know, he makes himself visual, or he just stands somewhere Ronnie can see him. So now Ronnie is aware of ghosts, and the flirtations begin, which suddenly makes it very clear why Bernard wanted Ronnie invited back, even though that's against the rules of the house. You know, it's kind of amazing that there haven't been more stories because of how sloppily the ghosts are handling things so far.
Yeah, it's like, I see why A, the guy could be grumpy about things, and B, they would want newcomers because they don't get them.
Yeah, but apparently something else has happened because the way they keep talking about it makes it sound like the last time they invited mortals to stay with them in any way,
Something horrible
something
went
extremely
wrong.
negative happened, and I don't know what that is. They allude to it throughout the 6 issues, but they never really state what the problem is.
They do in the end.
Well, not in the end, because in the 4th issue, it becomes very clear that Maurice is capable of eating humans, and he's irritated enough to do the same to Daphne. Whether that's what happened to create this rift, I don't know, because it almost sounded like somebody was banished forcibly by mortals, and it created a separate group of problems. But again, we don't have any firm details other than Maurice will occasionally eat humans when he's hungry enough.
Yeah, because he's a ghoul.
Yeah, and he goes very. He basically goes Nightmare on Elm Street on Daphne. He is following her through the place and making all kinds of problems.
Yep.
But before he can actually do anything about his hunger, Boyd shows up and uses her weird ghostly telepathic powers that apparently only work on ghosts. And Agnes shows up and uses an ancient technique she learned from an older spirit to banish Maurice. And it's.
Now, I was always wondering, is he banished? Is he vaporized?
From what I understand, he's a wisp. He is still on Earth, but he is first not tethered to the apartment complex anymore, and second, whatever she did makes him practically incorporeal. He's not able to interact with the world in any way anymore.
I mean, on one hand, that's good.
Yeah, and I also picked up in dialogue that he's practically lobotomized. So he is not going to be an effective member of life or the afterlife anymore. Which is a little terrifying that Agnes has that kind of power.
Yeah, I want to know more about that little tidbit.
Yeah, and in the 4th issue, though, I mean, about the time you're wondering whether or not or how permanent things are going to be, Agnes, instead of explaining herself, sends Daphne on another errand. And in this place is to send flowers to the grave of a Sean Terrell Boyd, the same last name as the black ghost sounds terrible, but the black woman who's a spirit within the apartment complex. So Daphne interprets this as being some kind of backhanded warning, and before she can burst, she bursts into Agnes's room asking about to ask questions, when she realizes that the other spirits are surrounded around something else, and what we find out is that Daphne's basically, fangirl rock dream, Zola Tesla, has just died and has somehow been tethered to the same apartment complex.
Yeah, so she's all smitten fangirl.
Yeah, and it's a very strange situation. Meanwhile, her, I don't want to say corruptive, but kind of overbearing best friend is concerned that she hasn't gotten any messages back from Daphne and is going to get herself to LA to find out what's going on.
I mean, that's what best friends do. Even if you're in a fight with somebody, you care.
Yeah. So the mysteries kind of deepen around everything, and in the 5th issue, a lot of it has to do with Daphne trying to connect with Zola Tesla. Because Zola just died, and I guess you could say the circumstances of her death are unsure, but she thinks she might have killed herself. And unfortunately, it's one of those existential questions. When your purpose in life appeared to be making music, however, now you're in a situation where you cannot interact with any musical instrument, what good are you?
That's depressing.
It is, and that's basically what Zola's going through. She is sitting in the pool, even though she can't drown in it, and that moment where she just kind of brushes off Daphne and says, I'm going to see how close I can get to the sun now. Wow.
Just like, okay.
Yeah.
Somebody's being a little moody.
Talk not ready.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, when Daphne's friend Christy shows up at her dorm room and meets Michelle, that was definitely two rams battling for space on the mountainside.
Oh, yeah.
You know, neither one was going to give up an inch, and neither one is the friendliest person. Meanwhile, Ronnie is showing Bernard his dorm room, and Ronnie's more of a guy than you would think, because his room looks like the disaster area I usually keep mine from becoming. But he and Bernard are just kind of laying on the bed together, about to have a romantic moment, when Christy is knocking on her door looking for Daphne.
I would say she's practically knocking it down.
Yeah, Christy is dangerously close to stalker territory.
Yeah, well, you know, also, when you're worried about your friends.
Yeah, that barrier is razor thin. So Daphne is just kind of upset because she can't seem to connect with Zola, as everyone has asked her to do, and before she can really get deep into it while she's working on school, Zola reappears in her room just kind of staring at the posters of herself on Daphne's wall.
Mm-hmm.
And Zola's ready to apologize because she appears to have gotten through some of her depressive funk, and she seems to have realized that Daphne is trying to help in her way.
Uh-huh.
But Zola is still having a little bit of an existential problem as to what she is, what she can do, and what she can't do.
Mm-hmm.
However, once they go to the basement of the apartment complex, someplace neither of them have been, they find a guitar, and Daphne convinces Zola to show her how to play some music, which is a good way to start to build some type of routine, really.
Yeah, and kind of give her purpose, because music is her life, or was her life,
mm-hmm.
and it was a sweet little scene where, and she's like, hey, she was starting to open up, she was starting to feel like, make those connections, feeling maybe not so isolated and alone.
Yeah, I did read a bit of a vibe between Daphne and Zola starting in at that scene.
I was going to ask, because it kind of looked a little vibey.
It seemed that way, and I couldn't tell if it was just relief at finding a purpose or relief at finding a person.
Maybe a little bit of both.
It could be. But it was also curious that while another conversation was happening and they tried to hide, Zola found a door that she can't face through in the basement, and it looks like the kind of door that you expect to open and find a talking lion and a satyr on the other side.
Yeah, or, you know, something sinister behind it, or maybe trying to keep something sinister in, and it begs the question, okay, is this going to be a Pandora's box? Do we want to open it?
Well, it definitely didn't fit the architecture of the rest of this place, which is very much like Art Deco 1920s, and right. This it looks like something the Dread Pirate Roberts is getting ready to kick down, so
right, it definitely was out of place.
So, in the sixth issue, we get a little bit of background to Ricky and find out he has been shy all of his adult life, more or less. And unfortunately for Ricky, he was, I guess in the modern times, he was expecting to have some kind of conversation about music, and then there's just Daphne and Zola testing what they might feel if Daphne walks through Zola.
Uh-huh.
That sounded way worse than I thought it was going to.
Yeah, I'm just like, okay, now, like, wiggle your foot. Okay, what am I watching here?
Yeah, and, so, Daphne still has to go, and Boyd, or Zola ends up talking to Boyd and finds out that they have abilities of some sort. However, Zola has not been able to find out what hers is, as well as she wants more information from Agnes about this place. Why are ghosts, seems like, routinely tethered to this location? Is there any other kind of purpose? What's going on with the door? And Agnes is a master at deflection.
Oh, yeah.
The dialogue there was kind of amazing, because Agnes didn't even seem flustered. She just managed to keep turning the conversation every time Zola started to approach a subject she obviously didn't want to answer.
Which there are many of.
Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, back at college, Daphne has been run into by Christy, And Daphne's doing her own Daphne's doing her own deflection by trying to get Christy to just see the sights of LA instead of asking a lot of questions about where she might be living right now.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, look, something shiny over here.
Yeah, and they start doing a lot of very touristy things in Los Angeles. But when Daphne returns back to her apartment, she turns on a light, and there is a glowing heart and arrow that's been drawn into her wall. Apparently, that's Zola's ability.
What did she call it? Ghost ink?
Ghost ink would be a good way to put it. I mean, if you wanted to get technical about it, I guess it's some kind of ectoplasmic writing, but that sounds creepy.
Yeah, maybe a little unsanitary.
Yeah, I was actually a little concerned as to whether or not that was energy or something physical.
Or, like, actually part of her, because there's another scene where it looks like she's kind of melting and phasing in and out.
It looks more like she's unraveling.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what was going on, but she was hiding in the bathroom. Even though, you know, ghosts can phase through things, they at least respected her privacy.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest scene in all this was late in their whole adventures in the city. Daphne and Christy met up again, and Daphne just lost it with Christy because Daphne felt suffocated. And mm-hmm. I can't say she isn't wrong, because Christy tried to monopolize all of her time during the period they were together.
Yeah, she wanted her to miss classes. Like, yeah. Who does that?
I don't know. And Christy, I'm not going to say she's a bad person, but she definitely does not have a good sense of boundaries.
For sure. And I'm thinking that maybe, given what we know about Daphne from her past relationships and things alluded to, she doesn't know how to say no. She doesn't know how to establish boundaries. So when she realizes, whoa, I really need to, she puts her foot down, and it's so sudden and clumsy that it does end up hurting her friend a little bit, stings a little bit. But her friend then gives like this backhanded,
she basically blames Daphne for needing space, would be the short way to put it.
Yeah, and she tries to pull a guilt trip for standing up for herself, but she'd been telling her to stand up for herself for a long time. Mm-hmm. It just didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of us know somebody a lot like Christy, somebody who just has no idea when they're taking up too much of their friend's time. And another, in the last few pages here, Daphne's hiding out in her own dorm, in her old dorm room, because it's quiet, and she's talking to Ronnie about the ghost that she lives with and how she can't figure out how to tell. She doesn't think there's a right way to tell Christy, I'm living with ghosts. Unfortunately for her, Michelle was walking up and heard the last part of the conversation.
Yep, so, awkward.
Yeah, when this whole thing ended, I mean, it occurs to me that Michelle may be a little bit dangerous going forward, because if she's a devout Christian, she might actually have, not the capability, but some kind of means to be able to expel spirits.
Or know somebody who knows somebody who knows a priest.
Right. So, I mean, in future stories, Michelle could become a major antagonist, although by trying to do what is generally considered the Christian norm. So, there's aspects of this story that are fun, but for the most part, a lot of this was, it was a bit more CW than I needed.
Yeah, it was definitely written for a younger audience. It seems it had good bones.
Yeah.
I like kind of the basics. The follow through was a little messy, but I might actually follow it just to see how they handle the resolution. You know, if there's answers to all the questions that did arise, you know, what's behind the door? What's all the ghosts' deal? What's, you know, Agnes's big secrets? You know, how does Daphne adjust to living in LA? Because she's definitely not a city girl by any means.
I think that was part of my problem with the story, was that Ghosted in LA, as far as these six issues, definitely occurs in its own particular bubble. There's not much of the spirit of, like, the place that Daphne finds herself in it. And she's just, she's continuously browbeat by everything around her. I think if there was a little bit more of Los Angeles in the story, combined with Daphne being a little more self-assured, I would have had an easier entrance into this story.
Now, I've never been to LA, so, you know, I wouldn't know this place apart from Chicago, New York.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any distinct places that would set it apart for me.
Well, I mean, then again, the story itself had the city And I know that the story's in Los Angeles, but the way that this whole thing was laid out, it could have been in just about any city because we saw so little of it. There was no real distinctive nature to the location outside the college and the apartment complex.
Right, and that's the point I was trying to make, that it didn't feel maybe like they did enough scene setting. Like, I know they had a lot of backstory and several different characters to kind of organize, but it seemed a little vague on the details.
Mm-hmm. There was time spent with the characters. There was just no time spent with the location and what it may offer.
Yeah, even when Daphne and Christy were being tourists, they could have used that chance to bring in aspects of the city, you know, but maybe the writer's never been to L.A., doesn't know what to do.
Oh, I'm sure Cena Grace has been here a couple times. I mean, he had to go to San Diego for Comic-Con. It was just a case where the series definitely felt like it was within a bubble. And there was a couple pictures of locations I recognized within L.A., but that's because I've lived here and I've studied, like, some of the touristy items around it.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately, it was just a case where it really didn't feel like Daphne or Ronnie or Christy really ran into anything that would, I don't want to say be distinctly Los Angeles, but even ran into any of the cultures within the city. And Daphne being a kind of a tight-wound individual, there it almost feels like there would be a story about her trying to acclimate herself to the city, being a country Jewish girl from Montana.
Right, and I think that there'd be several aspects of culture shock, not only just to adjusting to a new city, new college, you know, different ethnicity groups. I think that there was a missed opportunity there for sure.
Yeah, it probably would have helped if there was a scene in the first issue that had Daphne go somewhere between leaving Ronnie and heading towards the apartment complex. It was just kind of a point A to B. There wasn't any real... Again, there was no real sense of the city or the location outside these very tight confines.
And I refuse to believe that she could get around a big city without a vehicle.
You can, but, I mean, it's like the thing with the cemetery would have taken her half a day at least.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm being generous with that estimation. But it's not a terrible story by any means. It's just, it is missing a few pieces to make it entertaining for me.
I mean, I found it entertaining. It was kind of like one of those lighthearted, more cutesy things, not another world stuff like we had been reading.
Yeah.
I picked it up just out of curiosity. I liked the premise, and I was like, you know, this would be something new, something different.
Yeah, there's 12 issues out right now. It could be that the second volume picks up tremendously. I just, based on the first volume, it wouldn't be enough to make me read the second initially.
Okay, I mean, that's valid.
I did have a couple suggestions going into the next part of the this month.
Okay.
And I know I've got Bitterroot on tap for us to read, but it occurred to me that because things tend to slow down, it may be a better time to have some more detailed conversations. So how about for the next 2 weeks? Next week we have some good conversations about Ten of Swords, what it means, what it could mean going forward to the X-Men line. And then the week afterwards, we do that thing we were teasing, where we just kind of sit down and talk about Batman in Gotham City.
Yeah, I agree. That's a conversation that we've had snippets of and sidebars with, but it would definitely be a full-on conversation piece.
Well, both of those feel pertinent, not just because Batman's supposedly changing his mission within Gotham, but, I mean, the X-Men have definitely turned a corner in Marvel and have become a force to be reckoned with, and now things have changed again. So it feels like both of those deserve really just kind of spotlight conversations and trying to understand it a bit more, both in the context between each other as well as whoever's listening who may not have actually read these stories to find out what's going on.
Right.
So, it felt like a fun way to spend the next couple weeks.
I'd like that, yeah.
All right. So next week we'll be talking about the Ten of Swords story in Marvel Comics. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. I hope your holiday was fun, and I hope you and yours stay safe out there, because goodness knows we are not doing this pandemic thing well at all. But you have a good one out there, and listen to the CDC. Have a great one. I am Jeremy.
And I'm Joanna.
The Cosmic Library is now closed.